Hi everyone, Anthony here. Before we start, I just want to let anyone listening in or around the London area know that Gosh, the amazing comic store on Berwick Street, is hosting a launch party for my next graphic novel, The Coldest Winter, which is the sequel to The Coldest City, which, as you may know, is now being made into a movie starring Charlize Theron that will be released next summer. The launch party is on Friday, December 9th, starting at 7pm at Gosh, which is number 1 Berwick Street, right down there on the corner. So if you're in the area and you fancy meeting me, having a chat, and who knows, even grab a copy of the book, this is going to be your best chance to do so. It's going to be lots of fun, and I would love to see Unjustly Maligned listeners there, as well as comic people. Did I mention that the Gosh editions will come with an exclusive limited edition bookplate with new art from Stephen Perkins? Well, now I have, and they will, which is awesome. So do come along if you can, Friday, December 9th at Gosh from 7pm onwards. And now, on with the show. Welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the film critic and podcaster Moises Chuyan. Moises, welcome back to the show.
I'm thrilled to be back. I hope your listeners aren't getting sick of me.
Oh, right, it hasn't even been that long, has it?
No, and now I'm developing a pattern. I have to somehow break out of being the guy talking about movies that have alternate cuts and that sort of thing. There's something of a mini series going here.
Well, and the backstory, just to fill people in, the backstory, as it were, to this episode is that people who remember your last appearance was on my birthday episode where we did the role reversal thing again, and I talked about Dark City. But what people don't know is that you and I were talking before then about me actually defending the movie you're about to defend in this episode. And then I sort of thought, I thought about it a bit more and thought, hang on a minute. Dark City, I think, would be more interesting for me, from my perspective, I think. I basically bargained with you and said, would you do that movie instead if I then let you come on and talk about this one? And you very kindly agreed.
Well, I don't know exactly how much of a bargaining it was, because you were saying, here are two things you absolutely want to talk about. Would you like to talk about both of them? Yes, that's not hard to say yes to.
Well, but I wasn't sure at the time whether you had the same kind of love for Dark City as I did. So
even more overflowing, I guess.
It turned out, yeah, but I didn't know that. So, and with this being the Halloween episode for 2016, it seems very appropriate to things have worked out pretty well, actually, to do a movie like this. So without further ado, tell us what you've come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around its release, its reception, why it is maligned, and why you think that that is terribly wrong.
I am here to defend 1992's Alien 3, directed by Rennie Harlan, and then Vincent Ward, and then finally, in actual shooting, David Fincher.
I didn't know Rennie Harlan was involved. Good Lord.
Rennie Harlan was the original attached director, you get a really great decompression of the incredible chaos that the production of this movie was on a making-of documentary made by the great auteur of making-of documentaries, called Wreckage and Rage, and the auteur being Charles de Lozierica, whose name people who pay attention to DVD special features may know from Dangerous Days, the feature-length documentary about the making of Blade Runner. He is responsible for producing the special features on loads and loads of Ridley Scott movies, as well as various others, and is truly, in my mind, one of the most underappreciated, undersung filmmakers of his time, who has been documenting the amazing stories behind the making of various things. I wasn't party to any of that when I originally saw Alien 3, which is the troubled second sequel to Ridley Scott's 1979 masterpiece Alien. The production of it resulted in there being really probably six different versions of it that kept getting bandied around throughout pre-production as to what direction they were going with it. At one point, it wasn't going to feature the character of Ellen Ripley as played by Sigourney Weaver at all. In some versions, it was going to feature her very little. And then finally, as Sigourney Weaver got her demands agreed to, as it were, suddenly it was a movie very much all about Ripley. The discussion of the plot and the rest of the episode is going to involve spoilers, not just for this movie, but for Alien and Aliens. You may not necessarily be spoiled if you want to experience Alien 3 the way that I did originally, which was as the first movie in the Alien franchise that I saw all the way through.
Which blows my mind.
I was 9 years old when this movie came out theatrically.
Oh, wow.
And
you're so young.
In elementary school, the Friday the 13th series, all kinds of other R-rated movies were being readily marketed to kids. I mean, there were Aliens toys on the shelves before Alien 3 came out. And I think they were re-released or something like that. I'm pretty sure that there were toy commercials. I'll actually endeavor to try to find some of those and send them to you. But I know for a fact that Alien 3 was being heavily promoted on an entertainment news magazine show that had some renown at the time, even though that may have diminished quite a bit since, called Entertainment Tonight. Which famously made film critic Leonard Maltin a household name in the States, and the iteration of the show that he was a part of before it became very much more the kind of Access Hollywood, really trashy tabloidy sort of a thing, is what attracted me to it. They would go behind the scenes on sets of movies. They would have this late night entertainment news magazine show, just hang out and talk to Jonathan Winters on the set of The Shadow. And those sorts of pieces were fascinating to me. And even though the actual production of Alien 3 was this gigantic, chaotic show, you wouldn't know it as a 9-year-old kid watching something about this scary movie in a series of scary movies that, even though it was scary, looked really cool. I wasn't really big, huge into horror. Horror terrified me. But I would occasionally, you know, there would be the free weekend of a premium cable movie network that would allow me to see all kinds of R-rated things I shouldn't have been seeing. But Alien 3, I have trouble remembering whether I saw it on tape at a friend's house, on cable at a friend's house, on one of those free preview weekends at my own house. But the thing that I found most striking about it then and now in its theatrical cut is that even though this diverges heavily from the first two movies, it's not really that scary. And if there are jump scares, they aren't so much jump scares as, okay, get ready, there's going to be a jump scare in a minute. Hold on, here we go. All right, there's going to be something that's going to be, oh, it's going to be shocking. Something's coming. It's coming right now. Oh, just you wait. Just you wait. Here it comes. And it's going to be awful.
Some of the music cues do kind of give the game away, don't they?
It really plays out as a coda to the magnum opus that the first two movies together make up. Granted, with different tones, people would say they fall into different genre. People say the first movie is definitively a horror movie. The second movie is an action-adventure movie. I don't think that's wrongheaded at all. I think they're different tones for the same contiguous story. And again, I warned, but, you know, spoilers for Alien 3, the thing that had many fans of the franchise up in arms, even to this day, people disowning the movie, saying that it's garbage, to throw it out, that's terrible, is that Aliens left us with something of a stitched together family with Ripley, Colonel Hicks, I think is his rank, Hicks, as it were.
Corporal.
Corporal Hicks, played by Michael Biehn, 10, 12-year-old Newt, and otherwise pretty bumped around, but still technically functioning crazy uncle Android Bishop. And people liked that. And you look at interviews with the cast, and Michael Biehn certainly wanted to come back for a better paycheck. The young woman who played Newt, she was up for coming back too, but we open Alien 3 with the killing of everyone but Ripley. And she is crash landed on a prison planet that that is occupied only in a 10-mile square area in a prison complex that is entirely male, and the inmates are the most dangerous, most despicable people who've committed all kinds of murder, rape, wanton destruction. They are the worst of the worst of the worst people.
You crash landed in an EEV, evidently separated from your mothership before you hit our atmosphere.
You have any idea how long you've been hypersleep? Because coming out the way you did can be quite a jolt to your system.
Yeah, I'll be sick for a couple of weeks.
Indeed.
Where are the others?
They didn't make it.
What?
They didn't survive.
I have to get to the ship.
You're in no condition for that.
You want to get me some clothes, or should I just go like this?
Given the nature of our indigenous population, I would suggest clothes. None of them have seen a woman in years.
Neither have I, for that matter.
This used to be a 5,000 convict facility. But it's been reduced to a custodial staff of 25.
Why?
Keep the pilot light on.
Pilot light for what?
Blast furnace! Natural methane! We have a foundry, Lieutenant Ripley! The inmates spawn lead sheets for toxic waste containment!
How do you know my name?
It's stenciled on the back of your shorts.
And there is a religious brotherhood that has grown up within this group of convicts, some of them truly seeking redemption and facing contrition, and others just kind of going along with it as, well, that's the thing that I guess we do.
Do you have any faith, sister?
Not much.
Well, we've got a lot of faith here. Enough even for you.
I thought women weren't allowed.
Well, we've never had any before. But we tolerate anybody. Even the intolerable.
Thank you.
That's just a statement of principle, nothing personal. You see, we've got a good place to wait here. And until now, no temptation.
So it's them and a very, very small staff, I guess, if you could call three people a staff, that are actually managing the complex. Every 6 months, a supply ship comes through and drops them supplies, and otherwise they have no interaction with the outside world. Many, if not most of these men, have not seen a woman in years, and we'll get into various themes, various setting issues about the movie that some people might find objectionable. You know, there are overtones of rape fear from the very beginning. And it's something that plays, I would say, arguably differently, these 24 years later than it did then necessarily. But something that's been fascinating to me is seeing the evolution of the people who hate the movie are just always going to hate it because they will always feel betrayed by the killing of Hicks and Newt, who they believe should have been allowed some sort of a happy ending. But the movie, and I would argue the entire franchise, is very much about how no matter how good of a person you are, you can't really earn good luck.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who have evolved, some of them contorting themselves into bizarre pretzel shaped twists to find ways to defend the movie. My defenses of the movie are wholly unrelated to some of the people who, to touch on a theme from the movie, have practically descended into religious fanaticism. About how 100% right and true their, I would say, very painstakingly contrived notions as to what makes the movie so great. To me, those things that they consider praise to me are problematic for a whole host of reasons. Where should we begin, Anthony?
Well, the first thing I want to say to give you some context from my point of view is I, being, it sounds quite a bit older than you, I saw this at the cinema. Anybody who listened Anybody who isn't aware, I can't believe any of our listeners don't also listen to the main show, but just in case they don't, Incomparable episode 319, which was just a few weeks ago, discussed the original Alien, titled Squirting Milky Fluid. And you can go and find that and listen to that and hear about my fairly early obsession with Alien and Aliens as time went on. So I was already a huge fan of the franchise when this movie came out. I was anticipating it. I was really looking forward to it, partly because Aliens had been so good, you know, like compared to so many sequels that are terrible. But also because, you know, you'd got this hot young director. Everybody was talking about David Fincher. I thought the concept of the prison planet was just a really great concept.
And the production design is amazing. It's
gorgeous. Oh, it really is, yeah. I mean, the trailers, it clearly was going to look great. I thought that, yeah, the concept was a really good one for, because you have to have the kind of the cut-off, stranded on an island style feel for, you know, this kind of movie. And I thought that was a good way of doing it. Yeah, I was really looking forward to it. And then I saw it at the cinema and I was a little disappointed, but not as disappointed as many, many other people. My line, because I literally went and saw it on opening night. And so, you know, when people would ask me in the following days, oh, you know, so you've seen it, what's it like? My sort of standard line was basically, it's a great movie. It's just not a great Alien movie. And I still stand by that. You know, I, if anything, actually, my feelings towards it as part of the Alien franchise have sort of warmed a little as the years have gone on. But I still maintain, compared to Alien and Aliens, it falls short. And I don't
absolutely
think, I don't think anybody except the most, as you say, sort of zealous fan would, you know, would argue with that. But I do think that it is still a really good movie. And I know there are all these problems in production, you know, which I'm sure we will talk about. And, you know, I know it was kind of plagued with problems, but what came out of it at the end was, I think, still a really great movie. And thank goodness they didn't film the William Gibson screenplay, which I don't know if you've read that, but he was asked to write an Alien 3 screenplay, you know, years before this actually went into production, and it's not great. I'm a huge Gibson fan. Huge Gibson fan.
Yeah, me
fan.
Too. I agree. At Great Dismal on Twitter, one of my favorite people to follow and keep an eye on.
Right. I mean, he's one of the few living authors who I will buy any book he releases sight unseen, and it goes straight to the top of my reading pile.
William Gibson does the phone book, as it were.
Right, exactly. But his Alien 3 screenplay is really not good.
Well, it's, there's a reason that I'm not going to go in depth as to what's contained in his screenplay, which I might gently reveal toward the end of the show. But what was your impression of it? What are the high points that you would share with your audience that make it truly
screenplay?
Yeah, truly, truly dreadful.
Honestly, it was so long ago that I don't even remember that much about it, other than I think somebody goes, you know, there's a sort of fight with an alien on the outside of a space station at one point, and I just remember it being dull. That's literally all I remember about it. It was so long ago, and I was so uninterested by it that it just kind of faded from my memory, and I confess I haven't revisited it in preparation for this because I wasn't expecting to be put on the spot like that.
it is not great. He's not terribly proud of it. I think he tweeted about it when somebody wrote an article about Alien Covenant, which is coming out next year, mentioning that there were elements of creature design or world building that were clearly drawn from his script. It's not great. He isn't in love with it. It was very much a work for hire thing. It was like, here, do a pass on the second sequel of this franchise. And, you know, to your point about it being a good movie, not a great Alien movie, I think a big part of the problem is following on the steps of James Cameron. It's not that, you know, James Cameron is some God created director, the auteur of all dreams who imagination bows its head to. But the tone of Aliens being this like men on a mission, Vietnam War era type action adventure sort of thing, you go from that into something that almost no matter which version of Alien 3 they had gone with, they would have ended up with something that in general terms would have been like the movie they finish with, which is this pretty nihilistic march toward death as an inevitability.
Mm-hmm. Which is one of the things I like about it, incidentally. You mentioned the killing off of Hicks and Newt and, to an extent, Bishop. And I know that some people have a real problem with that. And I understand why. But I don't. Never had a problem with that.
There are people who will just flip the table on you. I think one of them being Jason Snell, saying, nope, sorry, movie is dead to me. Doesn't exist. It's awful. I have no reason to ever watch it again. That's terrible. That's horrible.
And the argument is that it negates everything that, you know, that all of those people worked for to survive. It negates all the sort of victory of the previous movie. And yes, it does, but that's dystopia for you. That's kind of why I like it, to be honest. It's like, yeah, let's just strip all that away, get back to Ripley on her own with a bunch of men who don't listen to her, dying all around her. You know, it is very much like the first movie in that sense. The only difference is that, of course, these men are much more physically capable, but also Ripley has the knowledge from the first two movies, which is what makes it a very, very different movie to the first one.
You know, you have these people who are about the most resourceful people that you could, I guess, in a way, hope for in a situation where you have no guns, you have no real weapons, you have to just work with what you have.
But you still need to commit extreme acts of violence, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing that I will say is that the version of the movie that I prefer to rewatch is the 2003 assembly cut, which is more based on the actual assembly edits that David Fincher put together before reshoots, before he was effectively pushed into the back room, out of the decision making of the movie. And it further fleshes out the supporting characters who are given short shrift in the theatrical cut, but still have character to themselves. And one of the things that I kind of like about the theatrical cut in comparison to the two is that the shaving of everybody's heads, and the fact that everybody's one of these working class blokes, you know, they all kind of blend together into this communal mass of sameness, with the obvious exception of Charles S. Sutton, who has a different temperament, and he's the one non-white person in the whole movie. You have this really interesting dynamic of these men who have been, if anything, molded like the mining facility around them molds lead into very samey, generic, awful people. You see them through doing this work to try to trap the alien, kill the alien, survive. You see their individuality come back from within them. And it's an interesting character journey for them. Now, are these all terrible people who've done horrible things? Yes, absolutely. You know, there is a bit of a redemption arc in it for different people. But again, facing the certainty of death, this is a movie where the bad guy has already won before the movie has started. And being able to come to grips with that is something that I feel like is something that to really own the whole franchise and its central antagonist, its central negative force, you have to be able to accept the fact that you know, that people die and bad things happen to good people who otherwise do the right thing or seem like they have come out the other side of something, you know, in a positive way. There was tie-in media that was written with the assumption that Hicks and Newt were going to survive that ended up having to be re-dialogued. And I'm actually kind of totally fine with the fact that they disappointed a lot of people at the beginning of this. You know, something we'll get to later on is, you know, in terms of where the franchise is going from here, if I had my druthers, how I would continue things. There's another sequel after this one, which is even more roundly disowned than this movie is. But I feel like this movie is something that is necessary to the franchise, even though it doesn't mesh with what people like the best. This is far from the Godfather 3 of alien movies. It does not fundamentally betray the stakes and the tropes that it sets up for itself.
Right. If anything, Alien Resurrection is more guilty of that. I mean, Resurrection is a movie that I will not defend. Resurrection has like four good bits that I can think of off the top of my head, and the rest of it's pretty much forgettable.
I could go ahead and mention it here. I mean, when Neil Blomkamp, the director of District 9, was talking about doing an Alien movie, which he's no longer doing, his plan was to ignore the third and fourth movies completely, just act like they had never happened, and effectively hit the reset button. And I feel like the cavalier way that he was talking about doing that bugs me, because again, there is something to be said for it was all just a dream being a terrible way to go about doing things. But honestly, that's the route that I would take, because if there is a doom filled hypersleep nightmare that Ripley would have, it would be the third Alien movie.
Right.
And she says in the movie, I had a terrible dream in hypersleep, just saying that, you know, that what she saw happen as she was coming out of cryo sleep, which is what actually happened, she thought that it was a nightmare. So if anything, going with that notion is something that to me validates, in the one instance that I feel like it would actually work, it validates the it was all a dream, it was all a terrible dream plot mechanic, in a way that totally works, where right. She very vividly feels all of this, and you can go in a totally different direction with quote unquote what actually happened, in a way that actually gives you something to build off of, that lets you do something like, you know, put the aliens on Earth, fall of the planet of the aliens, as it were.
Aliens Earth War. Yeah. The movie that everybody was kind of, all the big fans were like, when are they going to do Earth War?
That was even what some of the promotional trailers were advertising, you know, on Earth, everyone can hear you scream, because they literally didn't know what movie they were making until they started shooting it. the whole movie's dynamic of being Ripley versus the certainty of death, and Ripley versus the most toxic of toxic masculinity, are dynamics that I think are important and interesting. And thanks to the fact that they don't just put a lot of gratuitous rape fear, jeopardy into it, there is one notable interest of it, instance of it rather, that they get on and they get off of.
They address it and then kind of, don't dwell on it.
Yeah. They are far too distracted by survival to care about their, you know, their carnal desires and power trips and everything.
I actually prefer the theatrical cut to the assembly. I admit I haven't seen the assembly cut since it was released, which was a while ago now.
Well, you just hate Paul McGann. That's what it is. You hate Paul McGann.
No,
you don't want to see him.
I love Paul McGann. But the changing the, and again, like massive spoilers from anybody who hasn't seen the movie, but changing the host from a dog to an ox, I don't think really adds anything, and actually contradicts the idea that the host has to be, you know, alive for the chestburster to survive. And the ending, most importantly, I mean, the start's quite slow as well, but most importantly, the ending lacks the queen, which is kind of makes the ending of this movie for me. That is, you know, gives the ending a perfect apocalyptic sacrificial feel. It's
lacks
kind
the
of
queen. No, the ending in the assembly cut is virtually the same as in the theatrical cut. They just change.
Right, you don't see the queen coming out of her.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
In the assembly cut, you don't actually see the queen burst out.
I do hate that, come to think of it.
There you go. But they're not all that different other than that. As you say, there's a bit more, there's some pacing things.
Yeah.
There's the thing where they trap the alien, but it's mostly about character stuff with the inmates. And while I agree with you that they sort of start off as a homogenous mush of shaven-headed inmates, and then, you know, as they start dying, basically, some of them come to the fore and become more personalities. I think also it helps for audiences here, at least, that, the opening rumor control scene where they're all in that big circular area with the balconies and the steel gantries.
This is rumor control. Here are the facts. As some of you know, a 337 model EEV crash-landed here at 0600 on the morning watch. There was one survivor, two dead, and a droid that was hopelessly smashed beyond repair. The survivor is a woman.
I just want to say that I've taken a vow of celibacy. That also includes women.
We've all taken the vow!
I'd like to say that I, for one, do not appreciate company policy allowing her to freely intermingle with inmates and the rest of the staff.
What brother means to say is we view the presence of any outsider, especially a woman, as a violation of the harmony, a potential break in the spiritual unity.
We are well aware of your feelings in this matter. You will be pleased to know that I have requested a rescue team. Hopefully they will be here inside of a week and evacuate her ASAP.
That is just a who's who of British character actors.
It's insane.
It is amazing. There are so many faces. You go, oh, it's him. Oh, it's him. Oh, it's him from TV. Oh, it's him. It's just, it's full of them. Almost every single person in the movie. You're like, oh, I've seen him on TV.
Well, there are three different actors who all play prominent roles in Game of Thrones, a show that I don't watch. And yeah, I'm sure that I'll get assailed for, what do you mean you don't watch Game of Thrones? Well, I just don't. Sorry. But
wait,
you have
three. I know there's Charles Dance, obviously.
Charles Dance.
So we've got Ralph Brown from With Nail and I.
Right.
They
wanted to cast Richard E. Grant in the role that Charles Dance got, and it was almost a true With Nail and I reunion.
Wow. Charles Dance is very good in that role, though.
Oh, yeah.
I feel he...
He's magnificent.
Yeah. Paul McGann playing the crazy one. Pete Postlethwaite.
Mm-hmm.
The late Pete Postlethwaite, late great Pete Postlethwaite. Danny Webb, who is the only prisoner who survives. You have Chris Fairbank, who most British audiences know from Alvida's Own Pet. He played a character called Moxie in that. You have Phil Davis, who again is a British TV stalwart. Peter Guinness, again, like British TV. You even have a glimpse of Clive Mantle, who people over here remember from the Robin Hood, Robin of Sherwood series.
Yeah. And the Deobia Operai is the one other black guy in the movie aside from Charles.
Oh, that's
Dutton.
Right. Yes.
And he's Ario Hota in Game of Thrones.
Right.
And who is there? There's one other guy who's also on Game of Thrones. And again, because I don't watch the show, I'm just a giant waste. But the point being, there is this murderer's row of people that in some of the behind the scenes interviews, I think in one of them, Sigourney Weaver says, yeah, there was this great company of actors. You know, I knew some of the actors that I worked with on the first two movies. But I know Charles S. Dutton really well. I know some of these other actors so much better, more personally. And we could end up, you know, doing a production of Shakespeare together. And it really is this amazing laundry list of great actors that you get any two of them in one movie and you've got a good time. And all of these guys make the watching of this entertaining and interesting and anything but generic. And for me, it's got to be down to, they were shooting at Pinewood. They had access to all of these English actors.
They're just down the road in London. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. Okay. BBC, keep your TV paychecks. I'm going to go work on the Hollywood movie. And they were all tied up for so long doing this movie, doing so many takes over and over. And something that you see in the assembly cut is that, for example, the difference in the Bambi Buster, as it's called, coming out of the ox versus coming out of the dog. They did that in principal photography. They were shooting alternate versions of all kinds of things.
Wow.
Because they had no idea where they were going to go. They were behind the entire time that they were in pre-production. When they started shooting, their shooting script did not really dictate what they were going to end up with. The assembly cut that they first started test screening for people was around 3 hours long. And the thing that I like so much about the assembly cut is if you look at the individual deleted scenes, as it were. One of the great advantages of the Blu-ray is that it has both the assembly cut with captions noting scenes that were deleted, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Or you can just watch all the deleted scenes on their own. You see that some of these things are just very slightly longer, sometimes two lines longer versions of existing scenes that don't necessarily add in lines that just hang lanterns all over the place of, oh, by the way, this door is going to be important. Any of that kind of BS.
Right, right.
It's really much more about actually giving more texture to various characters.
Character, yeah.
Yeah, giving more lines to the less anonymous inmates, to the point that you start out hating all of them because they're all disgusting, horrible human beings. And then when literally backed up against the wall, you get to see more of this character development out of them in this longer version of the movie. It's about a half hour longer, with some scenes completely different and most scenes really just slightly tweaked in terms of the actual outcome of it. And one of the most bizarre performances in the movie is from Paul McGann, the Eighth Doctor, who I guess has the worst luck of any British actor working with Fox Studios. And I think a lot of it comes down to this being David Fincher's first feature film and just not having a handle on how he was going to direct people until he had already shot things. And then he had to kind of make do and figure out how to give people notes that he assumed that they didn't want to hear. One of my favorite bits in Wreckage and Rage, the making of documentary, is Paul McGann talking very frankly, because David Fincher doesn't appear, in modern day or, you know, after the fact in any form on this thing. Paul McGann talking about, getting the feeling from David Fincher that this like kind of Charles Manson-y, you know, whiny sort of voice that he was doing at one point was just not what the director was looking for. And, you know, being, you know, not knowing if he was going to get fired or what, and just getting the note from Fincher the accent. Don't do that. Don't do that. just don't. But I think the inexperience of the director is the least of the production problems that they had in putting together something that was going to be, amazing, sure, and spectacular. But even despite that, despite the various different problems, from the director's inexperience to the studios knowing that they went into production with a release date and not a script.
Yeah.
I think that sometimes,
which is much more common these days.
Oh, yeah.
There's an outline. In terrible movies. Yeah.
Yeah. There's an outline. There's a series of pre-visualizations. There's effects work that has already begun. So you have different set pieces that are already set and going to happen. I mean, that's really a style of production at this point.
Oh, that's also incidentally how a lot of video games are made.
I'm shocked. I'm absolutely shocked. How could you know that too? I mean, yeah. I'm sure that you've never been a part of one of these things, but I find that a lot of times compelling art comes from within a series of restrictions and obstructions in ways that you don't get when everything is easy. Everything is simple. I've been a part of so many theatrical, plays, musicals that are just utterly awful. And I'm trying to find ways out of it. You know, do I have a contract? How do I void this? How do I, you know, no longer have to be a part of this gigantic train wreck? And sometimes being a part of the train wreck all the way and seeing it up to the point right before the public actually sees it, you end up with something unexpectedly compelling and interesting and fascinating. And that's something that I feel like happened here. Yeah, it's a disaster in various respects. Yeah, it's not what people want necessarily. It's not pandering to people. But I consider that a credit to it rather than something to detract from.
Yeah, as a piece of art, it's fascinating because of that. It's enforced creativity, as you say, creativity that's made when you have restrictions and boundaries and sort of, you know, things that you can't do, forces you to literally think more creatively and sort of figure out how to get around problems. And sometimes the solutions to those problems are more effective than if you've got an unlimited budget and everything's going really smoothly and you just do whatever you'd actually written out in the outline. If you suddenly come to a point where you can't do what you wanted to do in the outline for one reason or another, and you have to figure out a way to get around it, that can sometimes be more interesting and, you know, be the result can be a really fascinating piece of art, which I think this is.
Well, metatextually, I don't know if you feel this way, but I love that this movie is almost an autobiography of itself, in that the company, Weyland-Yutani, being focused on the most dangerous, most volatile, stupidest thing that you could possibly do, very much mimics the way that the Fox Film Company under Joe Roth at the time was operating, where they were against all sense and all good advice, was just going toward the film studio version of weaponizing a malevolent alien organism.
Profit above all else.
Above all else. Yeah, let's take this thing that mercilessly kills entire squads of heavily armed people. Let's take that and let's use it. Let's find a way to just unleash it on our enemies. How can we turn this into a product on the shelf? I find that especially fascinating about this, where as we get toward the conclusion, we're talking about, you know, the company doesn't care about you. The company doesn't care about me. The company cares about this. The company cares about exactly what they can profit off of out of this. You know, they're not, you know, them knowing that you have seen this in and of itself means that they are going to kill you. They're going to make sure that nobody ever sees you or talks to you again. You know, you're kidding yourself if you think that any of us is getting out of this alive. That sort of unintentional thematic parallel to the actual making of the movie is something that I find absolutely just glorious.
I confess I'd never considered that before, but you're absolutely right. It's quite
entirely unintentional. Entirely unintentional.
Well, of course unintentional, yeah, but yeah, that's the point. Everything's unintentional when you get to that sort of stage of it becomes this monster and this roller coaster that you simply cannot stop, and all you can do is ride it to the end until it crashes into the buffers. I'm mixing so many metaphors here, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. It's the thing that drives me the most out of my tree from the side of people who defend the movie is people who defend the movie in a way that I hate people layering allegory onto things that could not have possibly been intentional, and we know for a fact was not intentional in this case. And the biggest source of that for me that just gets on my last nerve is people saying that this movie is an AIDS allegory.
I've heard you mention that before, and I've never heard.
It's
I mean, I don't talk about this movie a lot with most people because most people just go, a load of rubbish. I've never heard anybody put forward that theory, and I'm kind of struggling to see how you could put that on it anyway. Yeah, so well, how does that work?
You're struggling with it exactly for the reason that it's ineffable twaddle. It's ridiculous. to use one of Stephen Fry's favorite sayings of Arthur Conan Doyle's. The thing that drives me up a tree about people who I guess are latter day intellectuals who didn't actually go to school for English literature, or I guess do too much to actually study the kinds of stuff that they profess to be experts about, is when they say, well, this is obviously a statement about the AIDS epidemic because, you know, President Bush was just finishing his single term, and the Reagans effectively put people with AIDS out on an island and isolated them. So you're telling me that this is supposed to be an AIDS allegory where AIDS sufferers are being put in parallel with convicts who are rapists and murderers?
Wow.
That doesn't make any sense to me. And the defense articles that I find on Alien 3 still, even as recently as last year, I would find people propping this up as, well, obviously Alien 3 is about AIDS in the way that Aliens was about Vietnam. And to an extent, Aliens, yeah, it was a bit about Vietnam. It did have some DNA in common with James Cameron's work on Rambo First Blood Part 2. Absolutely did. But just because something has a little bit of a tenuous connection to something allegorically does not mean that everything's an allegory and everything means something, and that you can squeeze an amazing amount of meaning fuel out of even the tightest stone. That's what bugs me about defending Alien 3, is that I get cobbled in with people who have the most ridiculous defenses of this thing. You know, I'm sure that I will get tweets from him about this, but your ring theory guy who thinks that the prequels are absolute genius. It's that kind of, I respect the madness of it. but I don't respect the non-science of it, or the anti-logic of it. You know, that's the thing that I hate about liking this movie and having things that I find bold and fascinating and honestly courageous about a franchise movie that, granted, the studio had no idea what they were doing with it until they were finally done with it. And I assume they were just washing their hands of the franchise by the time they went into production, knowing that they were going to kill Ripley off. And, you know, we're going to juice this thing for some profit, sell some toys, and then be done with this trilogy franchise. You know, until they would later try to revive it multiple times.
And honestly, much as I, you know, as I've said, I'm a huge fan of the franchise. I love Alien, I love Aliens, and I do like this movie, but I would have been kind of quite happy if they had, because it does feel like they were trying to cap off the series here, killing Ripley, going back to the claustrophobia of the first movie. I would have been quite happy if this had been the last Alien-related thing to make it to the big screen, frankly. I think this would have been a really good way to cap off the series, because it is kind of apocalyptic, slightly cyclical, you know, a little elliptical, with her giving birth to the queen and the you know, self-sacrifice at the end and stuff. It is, it's just kind of fitting, you know, if that was the end. It's not satisfying in the sense of, like, the end of Aliens, because it is more of an action movie than a horror movie. It's an action movie with some horror elements, you know. The end of that does feel triumphant. It does feel, you know, you want to throw up the horns and go, yeah, because it's that kind of movie. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a great, great movie. The end of this movie does not make you want to do that at all. The end of this movie makes you want to sit alone in a darkened room and whimper. But that's what's so great about it. That's why I like it. And I think it would have been a really good way to round off the series. So it's such a shame that they didn't have that courage of their convictions.
The aliens are that black monster of death that we all grapple with as mortal beings. And to me, it really does. Yes, it's depressing. Yes, it's nihilistic. Yes, it's incredibly dark. Yes, it throws away the, you know, rah, rah, USA, USA, USA. And I guess as an American, I have to turn in my citizenship card, you know, for saying that I don't think that ending on an up note is something that this series was ever going to do. I saw the end of Aliens as the direct inverse of The Empire Strikes Back, where out of the realm of hopeful fantasy, we're dealing with a property that is steeped in the inevitability of death and the unfairness of death and the unfairness of life and the unfairness of existence. And I really honestly feel thematically, as depressing and unlike Star Wars, unlike the Metroid series of games, you know, there isn't this manufactured, uplifting, Love Conquers All ending to it. You know, Love Conquers All endings ruin all kinds of things. You know, look at what it did to Terry Gilliam's Brazil before he yanked it back, from the death grip of the studios, thanks to critics like Roger Ebert intervening and saying, no, this is ridiculous and stupid. The original version of the movie actually makes sense. Please let him do that.
Well, and I'm on record saying that, you know, maybe I should do this one day. I love the original, the first Silent Hill movie.
Oh, I do too. I do too. I think it's tremendously underestimated.
And partly because of the ending, which is so nihilistic and depressing.
Oh, it's so French. It's so French too. It's so impossibly French.
That's something
I feel like an Englishman can appreciate more than anybody else I would say it to, but oh my God, is it French?
It really is. Yeah. So for just the same reason. Yeah.
Ah, l'ennui. It is a terrible thing to have to deal with the unknowing of life, of death, of the afterlife.
The pain of existence. Exactly. Exactly. So I'm totally on board with you there. Yeah. I think, you know, it would have been, as I say, in terms of atmosphere and feel, a great way to cap off the franchise. But of course, you know, again, profit above all. So that was never going to happen, unfortunately.
I feel like people who want some sort of an uplifting, positive, rah-rah, you know, shooting guns and winning the day sort of ending out of the Alien franchise would be really well served actually by playing the Metroid games. The Metroid games, they don't publicly acknowledge it for reasons of potentially being sued, but it is so obvious that going back to the very original game for the Nintendo Entertainment System on through Metroid 2 for the Game Boy, Super Metroid for the Super Nintendo, which came out 2 years after this movie did, and does you know, lay the groundwork for the kind of symbiotic relationship between the alien threat and the hero, and a main character that is shamelessly based on Ellen Ripley, just, you know, in power armor at all times. If you are really looking for that, there are derivative works that give you a version of that. And I feel like the art should not bend to the will of the audience. The art should bend to the will of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And talking about influences, just one quick aside, have you noticed in this, and I only noticed this when I rewatched it this time around, that when Ripley sort of reactivates Bishop, you know, sort of to an extent anyway, just to chat to him, he actually refers to himself as a glorified toaster.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, I hadn't noticed that before. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's a really kind of, you wouldn't say that unless it was a reference, you know?
Well, the animatronic work on that revived Bishop is good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the great examples. There's tons of great practical effects work. There's a lot of great stuff in here, you know, where people today look at the Bambi Buster alien creature and go, oh, that thing's all CG. It's actually a puppet that was recorded against green screen and composited into the film. And
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's not an all CG. This is 1991 that they started production on this thing.
Right, so the CG wasn't good enough.
The CG wasn't remotely good enough, even in dark environments, even for something that is glossy black, piano black texture. So you look at it through a modern lens today and it looks like, you know, asylum horror level, like spoof movie stuff that somebody did on a laptop these days. But it really was as state of the art as they could get for the time. And makes me feel like they could have just made some concessions and gone all practical with it without compositing in the puppet. And it would have blended much more seamlessly. Because as it stands, when they do show the monster, it does kind of detract from the effect and feeling that you get from that iconic Ripley with her face up against the wall and the alien coming in on her right side,
which is obviously that's an in-camera puppet. Yeah,
yeah. That when you have something like that, and then you have something that has the seams all over it. That you do when...
Well, and isn't lit the same as the scene that it's being superimposed into either.
Right, that's, and God, know. I feel for those VFX supervisors. I feel terrible for them, and I don't blame them at all.
They probably didn't have the faintest idea what scene it was even going to be superimposed onto.
Yeah, so. And they probably had no communication as to how to light it, you know, what the lighting sources were, because on the set, the stuff that they were pasting it into, they probably didn't decide the lighting scheme until the day of, and they probably changed it four times. And I, if anything, I blame the executives, not any of the creatives involved in this movie, for any of the things that are ill-fitting, any of the things that don't match. And it's truly a miracle that the movie works as well as it does with the enormous pile of setbacks, infighting, and just garbage that they had to deal with.
Okay, so all of these problems were because of, as you say, the Bambi Buster, the four-legged alien, the quadruped alien. But that's one of the things I like about this movie. There are several things in it that, to the best of my knowledge, it's the first time that they appeared in the Aliens franchise that have since become quite established. I mean,
iconic parts of it. The Bambi Buster, actually the biggest thing from the assembly cut that I miss is the way that the Bambi Buster comes out of the ox and it's like this horrifying little cat that's just running down the hallway.
Yep.
That shot in and of itself, we don't get that from it bursting out of the dog.
We don't, that's true. But this is the first time, I believe, that in a movie, in if we assume that, much like Star Wars, that only the movies are actual canon and we ignore, you know, think tie-in media and stuff. This is the first time that the idea that the alien takes on host features is canon. I don't recall seeing that in Alien. Well, certainly not in Alien, and I don't recall seeing that in Aliens either. So there's that. There's the alien POV cam when it's chasing, you know, when they're trying to trap it, which has become a major feature of Aliens video games since.
Well, the taking on the features of the host thing is something that, again, in Wreckage and Rage, you get an extended little sit down with H.R. Giger, which I found hilarious, because as much as I love and am delighted by his work, and he's a legend and he's a genius, it's kind of terrifying. The one design of his that they used in the movie is the Bambi Buster, and he goes into talking about how I wanted to design alien that was erotic and has these lips like a lady. And I'm getting creeped out more and more every word that comes out of his mouth. And he's showing all these sketches that he refused to leave his studio in Stockholm. He just faxed everything over to them. And the guys that were actually supposed to realize all of this stuff were getting in all this stuff. And I feel for them idolizing him as a designer and getting in some stuff that was just, H.R. Giger, I wouldn't say resting on his laurels, but saying, okay, we're going to go crazy and they don't know what movie they're going to make. I send them crazy. And he sends them just reams of crazy, just designs that are out of their tree weird, that in a way the franchise, as it's grown in tie-in media and video games and everything, has grown to adopt some of the weird, creepy, scary stuff, specifically along the line of the alien creatures drawing off of the host DNA traits, and really broadening out the wide array of alien products, as it
right.
were.
Right. Well, and the very fact that it can infect non-humans, because in Alien, we only ever see that it's infected another humanoid alien, you know, the space jockey. Who, of course, you know, is not, we assume isn't an animal. We assume is, you know, some kind of humanoid civilization. Right. So,
God, are we going to talk about Prometheus at some point? I have a feeling like we might have to.
That might have to wait till the after show. the idea that it can infect animals, you know, non-humanoid, non-human hosts, as well as take on their attributes, but also the idea that aliens, that a regular alien, can sense the host of another alien, and maybe only a queen, but you know, but again, that's not in Aliens. You know, the very fact that there even is a queen is not revealed until the very climax of Aliens. So that's not in that movie. So as reviled as this movie is by many people, I think those people forget that there are many aspects which are now, as you say, iconic within the Aliens franchise, which are in this movie. They were, you know, this is where you first saw them. So I don't know. I think, you know, that's just one more way in which it kind of deserves a lot more respect than it gets.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And the one note on Prometheus, without going on at length, is that it's something that they very much wholly embrace within the storyline and credits tag of that movie, as being very much foundational parts of this universe and the rules and the way that things work. And there are definitely people who like disowning the deaths of Newt and Hicks, which are sad. And I feel, and you know, people would equate to the modern term of fridging, you know, you've got to fridge people to motivate the hero. For me, the notion of that kind of, symbiosis being a part of the rules of this thing is something that people were like, oh, this is ridiculous, and they've equated it since with, you know, the Hulk dogs in the Ang Lee Hulk movie of, oh, that's stupid, why do that. I think that this application of that sort of further branching out of this monster that is going to just keep growing and changing and becoming more lethal is something that absolutely works, and there's a good reason that it has been embraced so much by the tie-in media and the franchise at large.
Absolutely. One other thing that we haven't really touched on is the look of this movie. I mean, we've talked about the sort of feel and the atmosphere, and it is kind of bleak, and yes, a prison planet inhabited entirely by shaven-headed men is always going to be fairly bleak. But it also, you know, and this goes to Fincher's background, obviously, as a VFX guy and a music video director, it does look amazing, and it looks unique. Like, it feels like a part of the Alien universe without looking like either of the movies that preceded it. Alien was kind of, you know, overall gray and beige and, you know, very sort of workaday colors. Aliens was very like blue and green, yeah, and flashes of gunfire and the sort of cool blue night vision stuff. And now this is all like rust and orange and brown, and everything's on fire, and it just looks really, it looks great, but it also looks very different and very distinct to the other movies.
It's ostensibly Darkness and Corridors the movie, like the other two are, but it does have that, and it's not just a color palette swap. It's the texture of dust and grit and sand. It's very much ashes to ashes, dust to dust, the movie. Is something that works really well for, and well, this is something else that we haven't really talked about. We did mention Charles Dance specifically is just as we have these two sentimental characters ripped from us, we're introduced to this really fascinating, really interesting, really complex guy. And oh, wow, Ripley gets laid and it can't last. Just can't last. No. Just can't last. You know, it seems like, oh, we're getting a replacement. Okay, well, at least we're getting a replacement. Oh, no, we're not. Oh, yep. Okay.
Like almost immediately. Whoop, he's gone.
Yeah, the economy of storytelling is such that it's similarly brief in that we're introduced to all these people who are going to die. But it just that dynamic of things feels different, and not just because of the different look of the movie and the fact that everybody's head's shaved. But it feels like there's a different economy of storytelling of, okay, this is who this is, and this is who this definitely isn't. And as short as the theatrical cut of the movie feels, I mean, it's almost 2 hours long, but it feels closer to an hour because it moves pretty quickly. There's very little to define so many of the characters in the way many of them are just dust in the wind, as it were. But the look and feel of the movie is something that extends to, you know, whether Fincher intended it this way or not, the way that the majority of the cast come off in the actual telling the story.
Yeah, I agree. It does move at a fair clip. It's I think once you take out the credits, it's about an hour 50. Which is, I think, the shortest of all three of the movies.
Yeah, I think the second one might be just a few minutes longer, and the first one's just over 2 hours, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right, it is, I mean, Aliens obviously is very fast-paced.
Yeah.
But also has a lot of scenes. Like, you know, Aliens feels probably like a longer movie than it is, not in a bad way, but just because there are so many scenes and they all move quickly. There's no time wasted, but so much happens that it feels like a longer movie. Whereas in this movie, there isn't actually an awful lot that happens. There's only, you know, as you move through the acts, as like she lands, the alien is born, they try to trap it, they fail, it's, you know, kills a lot of them along the way, they try to trap it again, and this time, you know, Ripley sacrifices herself to kill it. That's pretty much it, you know, in broad strokes. Whereas Aliens, if you did the same thing for Aliens there, you'd probably have like a dozen major plot points, major sort of movements in the movie, I should say. And so I think that's one of the reasons why this one feels maybe a little shorter, even though, as you say, in the runtime, it's not that much shorter, because it, you know, there's not actually that much that happens. It's just that it moves quickly from scene to scene because there are so many characters. It's like a soap opera. There's so many characters that you can only afford to have a few minutes with each of them before you then need to move on to the next character and the next minor plot point.
Yeah, there's so much about this movie just in terms of basic storytelling that I think gets overshadowed by people deeply, deeply disagreeing with, well, that person and that person shouldn't die, and characters that I care about shouldn't die, and they're not allowed to die in this way because that's just not right. And that's just a bit too, and a lot of times this is coming from people who are not people of belief, and I'm not either. It comes off as fanatically religious about their idolatry of fictional characters.
Well, and even just the fact that there's a four-legged alien. Like, I know a lot of people who don't like this movie just because it's a dog-like alien.
Yeah, yeah. How about you take your sexy-legged alien and go to bed with it?
But I think they think that that makes it look ridiculous and makes the alien laughable rather than, you know, a credible threat, which I think is, I don't know, I find that a very bizarre reaction myself, because I think it's, you know, it was an innovative idea to make it a four-legged creature, just to give it something that was really different to the previous two. But, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. I, you know, I think this movie, like many other movies in a similar category, get maligned for the simplest and thinnest reasons, for it just betraying this, betraying that, and being different. And if anything, I think a lot of people like Aliens so much because of how different it is from the first movie, while still living in that world and playing by the most important rules that are set down in that world.
Yeah, I agree. And yet, but I think that's a criticism that some people, those same people, many of them have of this movie, is that it tries to return to the first movie in terms of feel. And, you know, and I would agree that it's not as good as the first movie. Good Lord, the first movie is an absolute stone cold classic. Uh-huh. You know, 99% of all movies out there are not as good as the first Alien. But I think that they did a good job with this one of, you know, sort of giving it a similar feel, at least. And, you know, but doing that while making it still a bit different and acknowledging that it couldn't be exactly the same for, you know, many reasons. So yeah, I don't know. I just think this is a really good movie. And I think too many people wrote it off for, as you say, for just not being what they wanted or perhaps what they expected after the, you know, massive, phenomenal success and popularity of Aliens. And of course, Cameron was never going to come back and do another one. So,
he had ideas for how he would continue the story. And that's something that goes into the apocrypha of the Alien universe. And that leads me to also throw out there that one of the things that bothers me the most about negative assessments of this movie is when they come from a position of, well, you know, it was troubled and it was chaotic. Yeah. Yeah. I'm fascinated by that story too. I love the making of documentary that exposes all of those rough edges, and gloriously, actually, one of the best things about it is you actually get on set during production footage of David Fincher dealing with his producers, his executive producers, that Fincher allowed them to use at the very, very last minute. So you don't have contemporaneous Fincher talking about the making of the movie, but he did give his blessing for them to show some of that, you know, 16 millimeter footage that was shot.
Right.
On the set itself, which is fascinating. All that stuff is fascinating. It's amazing. It's instructive. It's, you know, it's up there with Lost in La Mancha and other, you know, the unmaking of a movie, type of stories in terms of how deeply fascinating and all about the human condition it is and so on. Yeah, that's great. But knowing all of the, problems, all of the issues, all of the controversial things that happen behind the scenes of a movie. If people knew that for, I would say, 10 of their 20 favorite movies, it might ruin those 10 movies for these people who have assessed Alien 3 using justification of, well, it was a chaotic production. And
right.
I don't think those people know just how chaotic so many of these productions really were.
Almost all productions. Yeah, I was going to say, if you avoided a movie because you knew it had a troubled production, you wouldn't get out much. You would not see a lot of movies.
Yeah, Disney's John Carter movie. I don't think that I would do a full episode about it, or your audience would endure one. But if you actually see the movie, it's really quite good. There's lots of stuff in it that makes people say, oh, well, that's like Empire Strikes Back, or oh, that's like that thing from one of the Star Wars prequels. Yeah, because it ripped all that stuff off of the original John Carter of Mars story.
Well, and also just, you know, look, go and watch a documentary about the making of the first Alien movie. That was a pretty troubled production too. Yeah. And God, Blade Runner, you know, talking about Ridley Scott, Heavens, Blade Runner was a massively troubled production. Loads of problems, loads of, you know, last minute. There's a reason that the sky changes color at the, you know, during the climactic scenes, because everything was being shot right at the last minute and changed. It was, you know, that's literally my favorite movie ever. And I had a terribly troubled production. But ignore all that. Forget it. Just watch the movie.
Yeah, I told you before we started that I did a bad thing, and there are plenty of people who will say, oh, I'm poisoned. I only like this movie because it was the first one in the series that I saw. To expand on that, it was the first one that I saw all the way through. Then immediately after seeing it, I saw, or actually, I think I'm actually remembering the actual circumstances of my seeing it. I think that it was aired on one of the premium cable channels that was doing a free weekend as a marathon of all three movies.
Oh, wow.
Because I distinctly remember seeing the climactic ending sequence of Aliens either right before or just after I saw Alien 3. And it must have been that I saw literally the very end of Aliens, and then I saw all of Alien 3.
Wow.
and you know, there are those who would say that gave me an unfair soft spot for this movie. I unreservedly love the first two movies, and enjoy this movie and like it very much, and think that it deserves more credit than it got. But I put together, I think people were doing, you know, my seven favorite movies or whatever. And I on Twitter, and I ran in the face of what everybody else was doing and did a list of 77. And even in a list of 77 favorite films, I listed the first two Alien movies and not this one. And that isn't to say that I'm just standing up for it, you know, on principle. I think it's a good movie. I think it's enjoyable. And dear unjustly maligned listeners, I did a bad thing. Anthony, I did a terrible, terrible thing. And
confess your sins to me.
I hope that I have faith enough for you, brother. My wife and I love Jaws and Jurassic Park, movies that are notorious for really great jump scares, things that small children probably should not see for various reasons. And she had never seen a movie in the Alien franchise. And last night I was doing another look through Wreckage and Rage, and she came into my office and sat down and watched it. And there were some little bits of the movie that are mixed in there. And she said, "Do you think this movie would actually scare me?" And I said, "No, I really don't think that it would. Not at all. I think that honestly, on your thousandth viewing of Jurassic Park, the jump scares in Jurassic Park are more startling than anything in Alien 3, especially." And she said, "Oh, well, could we watch it? What version are we supposed to watch?" And I'm like, "I'm going to show you the theatrical cut, because that's what I saw first, and I'm curious about your reaction to it." And multiple times through the movie, she was like, "People hate this? How do people? I mean, it's not great. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's not amazing. It's not astounding.
Right. It's not some kind of work of genius. Yeah.
I'm not weeping and crying and bowing at the knees because, oh, the cinematic genius before me." And then once it was over, she was like, "Well, that was kind of a weird, stupid ending, but, you know, 'cause it is very abrupt." But
if you don't have the baggage, as it were, of the first two movies, if you're not taking that in with you, then I imagine the ending must, be a bit like, "Really? Oh, okay. Oh,
okay. Well, but she said, "No, that was good. That was, people really hate that." And she said, "You know, knowing that it was a really messy production, I could tell in the back chunk of the movie that things suddenly just kind of were a generic action movie, but okay. So it's the second sequel to a jump scare movie. Color me shocked.
I think that's another thing that people forget, because for so long, sequels were terrible. Like, absolutely, and I don't just mean like, you know, "Oh, that wasn't very good." I mean terrible, terrible. Yeah. Sequels, you know, for 90% still of sequels are awful. And then along came Aliens. Probably, you know, alongside, I mean, very different audience, but alongside probably Godfather 2, generally regarded as maybe one of the best sequels of all time. And it set the bar so high that this movie was inevitably going to fall short. However, this is still a really good movie. And as you say, yeah, this is the second sequel. How many franchises are still good by the third movie? Not many.
But Captain, you know? America. I mean, forget superhero movies. Right.
But that's a pretty small, especially movies that aren't designed to be franchises, like the modern, you know, stuff like the Marvel Cinematic Universe and stuff. But when you get movies that aren't really designed from the outset to be franchises, finding any series where the third movie is still pretty damn good, that's a very small circle of titles and franchises that you're talking about there.
Yeah, I think we've We may have beaten this one to death, just like the movie beat the franchise to death. But it's something that I would urge people to give a fresh set of eyes. I find this is increasingly common, especially in the age of social media, where everyone, and I know there are many people listening to this who are probably guilty of this, and I have been guilty of it in the past myself, assumptively judging something based on its reputation and acting as if they have seen it and know it and have an actual relationship with it, and just assumptively brushing it off as, oh, well, that was garbage. And in some cases, even thinking back to the one time that they saw it, and maybe they went and saw it with friends, or they saw it on VHS in somebody's den, and, you know, with a chorus of naysayers saying, well, this is garbage, this is terrible, this isn't as good as Aliens. Well, I heard that on set this blah, 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 happened. People allowing their perception of the movie to be colored by, in some cases, a 24-year-old single impression of it. Look, if you cannot deal with the nihilism of it, if you cannot deal with a story about impending death, I've been there. I've definitely been in places where I just could not bring myself to watch a movie like this. I get that. But trying to say that it's quote unquote objectively a bad movie, I think is wrongheaded. This is not a bad movie. It is a movie that you can feel does a bad job representing its franchise or the company, if you will. But it isn't incompetent. It isn't uncompelling in a way. It does not fail to actually tug on some emotional feelings. But if you really just cannot deal with movies that are escapist but at once delve into your own fear of mortality, then this is definitely not the movie for you. But don't come at me just saying that this is lazy, terrible, and that, you know, the alien creature in it should have been doing a hosiery commercial. You know, because of its sexy legs. Come on, really?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's not a bad or badly made movie. You know, there are plenty of those around, and this is not one of them. You can like it or not, you know, fair enough. But I don't think anybody would, you know, neither of us are blind to its flaws. It is a flawed movie, but that doesn't stop it from being a good movie and enjoyable to watch if, as you say, you're in the mood for the kind of movie that it is. So, yeah, I like you, I would encourage people who maybe haven't seen it for 25 years or 22 years since it was on VHS or whatever. Go back, you know, watch it again. Give it another try, because you might be surprised, actually, that, you know, at how much you enjoy it if you just kind of put all of that so-called background knowledge out of your mind. Just sit and watch the movie as a whole. I think it really stands up.
I just hope that somebody finds photographs or something else that they can use to blackmail David Fincher into actually going in and doing a proper director's cut of the movie.
That's never going to happen. Come on, that's never going to happen.
Yeah, and him directing Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was never going to happen either. And then look at that. And, you know, him doing TV was never going to happen, and he did House of Cards.
Yeah, but those things paid money. Do you really think anybody's going to offer him a meaningful amount of money to do a director's cut of Alien 3?
let's come back around to, like, you know, 68-year-old David Fincher and see if he wants to, you know, take 10 grand and go into the editing room and talk about every executive that he hates at Fox that he's never going to work with again.
Oh man, what a prospect. All right, okay, I think, as you say, we have kind of flogged this one to death. So Moises, thank you very much for coming on and talking about this movie that I do love as well. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
They can find me on Twitter at Moises Chiu, MoisesChiu. I've got a whole bunch of podcasts at esn.fm. The network's called Electro Shadow Network, named after the flagship show on my network, Electric Shadow, which is about, as I say it in the intros, the past, present, and future of cinema, which isn't just movies. You know, I talk about TV shows. I talk about old-time serials, the way that cinema itself is transforming in terms of visual storytelling with images on a glowing screen in motion. Most recent episodes, I've got a chat with Mark Hamill and Kevin Conroy. You know, he might be best known as Luke Skywalker, but they're both known together as the Joker and Batman from Batman the Animated Series. Chat with George Takei, a chat with Scott Derrickson, the director of Doctor Strange, where he talks at length about issues of whitewashing, Orientalism, racial representation, and the series of imperfect decisions that he had in front of him in casting and conceptualizing the updating of a 5-decade-old character. And I've got a whole bunch of other stuff posting here in the near future. People from Star Trek, the voice of Wonder Woman, Susan Eisenberg, for Wonder Woman Week. Lots and lots of stuff there. Comic book show about customer service, various other things. And I thank you once again for having me on, sir.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I think the themes of the omnipresent Omni company is something that is newly even more relevant than it was, where it was just this is going to happen back then. And now 25 years later, it's, well, so it's happened.
Right. Old news. Yeah.
Old news. And people convincing themselves, no, they're not tracking everything I'm doing. No, they're not taking advantage of recording technology that's built into products that I carry with me everywhere.
Oh, that was what cracked me up about Person of Interest. That was one of the things I loved about Person of Interest, was like the first two seasons were full of the idea that, oh, you know, we can hack into your phone and watch you through the camera and listen in through the microphone, even when you're not actually talking on the phone. And this was like crazy hacking sci-fi. And then, of course, Snowden happened and the PRISM documents came out, and it was like, oh, actually, this isn't sci-fi at all. This is all real. So they pivoted completely, like from the start of season three onwards. Suddenly it just changes completely, and all of that is old hat. And instead it becomes about the war between the artificial intelligences. And just the ability to turn on a dime like that, I really admire. Like, to look at it and go, oh, the real world has suddenly made our entire show irrelevant. What can we do?
Yeah, it's fascinating the way that some things have adapted to that, and others are still doing the, hey, can you enhance that grainy black and white security yes. camera footage? Hit the enhance button and then the double enhance button.
Right.
All right.
And then we can...
Does my hair look good right now? Okay.
And then we can read the license plate from the reflection in his eyeball on the photograph.
Yeah.
That's a real thing they
Everything
did
Everything is
CSI.
So high definition. Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, yeah. Man. But yeah, the whole, I mean, the makeup of Weyland Yutani, the whole company thing in Alien has been... It's never been, you know, very well defined. And that's probably for the best, because, you know, otherwise you get into, you know, movies that start off with trade negotiations. And that's never a good idea. I finally watched Winter Soldier on a plane, yeah, on my way over to Chicago before New York Comic Con. I hadn't got around to watching it yet. Really enjoyed it. Honestly, the Captain America, I'm only saying this because you mentioned Captain America 3, which was effectively Civil War, wasn't it? Which I haven't seen. But the Captain America,
it was a fascinating. It won't spoil the viewing of it, but I'll tell you my read on why it works as an adaptation of Civil War.
Well, does it work as part of the Captain America movie franchise? That's what I want to know, because...
Directly, absolutely.
Right, because I realized that of all the Marvel non-Avengers movies, the Cap movies are by far my favorite. And I know a lot of people don't like them so much, but I think they're great.
I think there's something weird where some people really just cannot wrap themselves around the first one. For some people, the first one really just turns them off. I think because it reminds them of their racist uncle or their greatest generation fathers right. who love watching history documentaries about, and then the Allies took it to the Nazis, and the Nazis sure took that bayonet up the ass.
Socked Hitler in the face, yeah.
Yeah, pow, yay, America. Which I guess is just, you know, it's out of style to wage war against fascist dictators who want to commit mass global genocide. But, you know, that's just me. The thing that fascinates me is that Ridley Scott is certainly not getting any younger. I mean, he's old, old. Yeah. And him having taken on this new alien movie beyond Prometheus, you know, I really wonder exactly what bits of threads because they've acknowledged that they had pretty much everything on the table of it's going to be Earth War. It's going to be, digging into the space jockey and who those people were and where the aliens came from and going to the origin point of the aliens. You know, all these various ideas that were being kicked around, that there was something interesting there or that they found very interesting as a studio, it seems like is the entire spread of stuff that Scott has seized on in reviving the franchise and taking the reins of it again. You know, Prometheus is something that, as a movie, I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. It was almost like the extended universe encyclopedia to the Alien franchise, in that I read it and it was cool, but it didn't really carry fascinating killer stakes for me in any way, really. And if anything, I enjoy the 4.5-hour making of documentary more than I do the movie.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Ridley Scott is 78, by the way.
Amazing. Yeah, he's almost 80.
Yeah. That's I mean, it's amazing that he's still working as tirelessly as he does. And I'm not a fan of a lot of his recent movies. You know, I think he's made a few clunkers in recent years. But just the fact that he has the energy to still be directing and moving pretty much without a break from job to job at his age, that's kind of amazing.
Well, that perpetual motion that he's kind of engaged in is something that I think is part of what keeps him going is that... Dick Van Dyke actually has said that, you know, one of the reasons that he's still so spry at 90 something years old is that he's exercising every day and moving his muscles and not letting anything atrophy. But with Scott, I honestly, you know, people are like, well, he's got to hang it up soon. And barring some sort of terrible illness or injury, I don't see him slowing down for the next 10 years.
Right. Yeah. I know what you mean. Unless he's forced to stop, why would he? Here's something that I've often wondered about, and that again came to the fore watching this one, especially when you get towards the end and the bishop guy, you know, supposedly the bishop's designer, comes in to try and persuade Ripley to give it all up. Weyland-Yutani has, we keep hearing that it has a bioweapons division, but apart from the alien, apart from the xenomorph, what other bioweapons are there? We don't see or hear any evidence that there is anything else other than that this entire division has been created for anything other than the xenomorph. There's, you know, because if they had anything else, wouldn't they have given it to the Marines when they sent them onto LV-426? I mean,
I don't think that they did, because they set the Marines up to fail in the first place.
Well, I suppose that's true.
You know, they were effectively cannon fodder for samples collection. My read on it is that in the same way that Apple created a car division, even though they're not actually making a car now, they set up a bioweapons division because they have an intense interest in that area.
Just in case.
And